We're specifically talking about the vertical union. And you'll hear me refer back to this so many times because basically what I wanted to get across in the vertical union was this. That it's more important who you are than it is who your mate is. It's more important who you are than it is in finding out who your mate is. That's the prerequisite for trying to figure out the whole scene of who you're going to marry. The problem with many marriage courses and many marriage books is that they're dealing with how to choose your mate without ever dealing with you. Because God is very, very interested in you and who you are and who you're becoming. That's the prerequisite for moving to find who that mate is. And then at the end of yesterday's hour, after I convinced you that I'm speaking to all married people in here, except for you few who have the gift of staying single, now we can move on into more sensible subject. And we're all on that presupposition. We're all on that basis. Everybody's agreed. I heard so much static yesterday, I couldn't believe it. After I got through making that one point, I never will forget that. I've been telling it all over. Somebody down here in the second or third row just went, ooh. So I'm sure that she was convinced or else she was mad, one or the other. I'm not sure what was going on. Today, we're involved with how to be sexy and free and like it. How to be sexy and free and like it. Or, candy is dandy, but sex won't rot your teeth. There are a lot of people who are here probably thinking that you're in the senior panic type of stage. Either you're 22 or 23 and you think, oh my, I may never get married at this rate. Or others of you are looking at the person that you're dating or going with and you're thinking right now, I wonder if I'm going to have to end up with him. And other you guys, you're looking at that girl and you think, well, that's for life. That girl for life. And you're sitting there trying to figure out, it's kind of a senior panic mentality. It's kind of like Adam and Eve, you know. Adam said, do you love me, Eve? And she said, who else, Adam? It's kind of that point. So some of you may be to that point today, and I want to deal with that. It's very easy for me to make some remarks today that may not be coming out the way I'm trying to make it come out, and that can be very embarrassing for me and can be very embarrassing for you. So you'll understand when I blow it up here that you will understand what I'm trying to get across. Kind of like the dean of women in this one school. She got all the women together and she said, girls, the president of the university and I have decided to stop petting on the campus. Now, she didn't mean that the way it came out, see. She was just setting up a rule. She wasn't talking about the president and her. But anyway, this may come through and we wouldn't want that to happen. There are two extremes in sex, two extremes in the philosophy concerning sex. One is the Puritan view. The Puritan view says we will want a lot of passion, a lot of love, but let's cool it on the sex. Now, we come from another extreme then. Reacting to that extreme is the Playboy. The Playboy philosophy says this: we want a lot of sex, not too concerned about the love or the passion. Both of these extremes are wrong. And I believe the reason why that we have these kinds of extremes is because basically we have a lot of misconceptions of what sex is and a lot of misconceptions of who laid down the rules in the first place. Before we can ever really get into much on sex, we really must understand principles of life. I'm talking basically what you've heard about doctrine. Doctrine, D-O-C-T-R-I-N-E. Now, if I told you that today we would expound on doctrine, probably I'd be the only one here. And I may not have come for that. But we're talking about principles of life. That's doctrine used the way doctrine is supposed to be used. Not as something in your notebook or in your frontal lobe, but doctrine is something to be used in application, in practical life. That's a principle of life. So don't say doctrine, say principle of life. Now, a principle of life is given so that you might have the best success, the highest success in any area that it's talking about. For instance, there's a principle of gravity. The principle of gravity says that if you go off a two-story building, you'll go down fast, you'll hit with a thud, and you won't like it. Every time you go off a two-story building, you'll go down fast, hit with a thud, and you will not like it. The principle says this: don't go off two-story buildings or any other kind of heights, because there's a principle that will take control there, and you will go down fast, hit with a thud, and you will not like it. Now, the principle of gravity is very illogical in a lot of ways. Very few people, if any, understand it. All we can do is observe it, and we know it's true. It seems illogical. People say, I don't understand it. And yet still, it's true every time. No matter what kind of two-story building you go off of, you will fall down, hit with a thud, and you will not like it. Now, let's say that somebody in here says, well, that's illogical. That's stupid. I think we ought to get rid of the principle of gravity, the law of gravity. So somebody makes a motion. Let's say that Gene Beekman makes a motion. And as he makes the motion, he says this is illogical, gives a lot of explanation why we shouldn't have it. And then somebody comes along, some other person says, I second that motion. Now, after we've got the motion made and seconded, we have a lot of discussion. And we can have person after person in the room saying, you know what? I agree. If we could get rid of the law of gravity, we'd all be really a lot better off, because I fell off of two steps the other day and stubbed my toe. And look at me. My leg is broken. I fell off of the back of a wagon one day when I was helping out on the farm. And we have all kinds of people say, hey, that's true. I'm still going through pain because I was caught by this terrible principle. So we all vote on it. And we decide that it's no longer in for the principle of gravity. We just vote it out. It's not logical. Nobody understands it anyway. Let's get rid of it. Who's going to go off the two-story building? Beekman. We take him and we put him on the two-story building and we say, now take one big step. And as he takes one giant step, he will find out that he will go down fast, hit with a thud, and he will not like it. Now, he may get back up and he say, well, maybe it's not in effect yet. People just haven't been notified totally what's going on here, so I'll try it again. And he gets up there, and the same thing happens again. This funny sensation of going down fast, hit with a thud, and he will not like it at all, and may not get back up. Now, a lot of people are breaking the principle of sex, or breaking the principle of life involved in sex or marriage. The principle is this: 1 + 1 = 1. One man and one woman coming together forever. One man and one woman coming together forever. When the principle is violated, you still live. You're still alive. You still have a spiritual life. But when the principle is violated, you cut your chances of having the best spiritual life. You cut your chances of having the best in the sex area. Every time you violate the principle, you hurt yourself. Every time you violate the principle, you fall down, hit with a thud, and you don't like it. So the principle of life is found in Matthew 19. Matthew 19, starting with verse 4, and Jesus answered and said, have you not read that he who created them from the beginning made them male and female? And said, for this cause a man shall leave his father and mother, and shall cleave to his wife, and the two shall become one flesh. Consequently, they are no more two, but one flesh. What therefore God has joined together, let no man separate. So God's principle is one man, one woman coming together, leaving their fathers and mothers, coming together and cleaving to each other forever. I want to go through some misconceptions in sex that I think are very important to get out of the way before we get into some other details. The first misconception is that God is down on sex. God is down on sex. This is a very good one for those who have been believers for quite some time. I know when I grew up in a church situation there, great teaching, but I had the feeling that maybe God didn't really go too much for sex, because all I heard was thou shalt not the total way. And any time anybody brought up the word sex, it was just like, hush that kid in the back, you know, this kind of thing. And I didn't even know how to spell sex till I was in college. It was just a weird thing. You know, I thought that God was against it too. Well, it's not true, and I want to give you some reasons why God is for sex. Probably more so than you thought. First of all, he made the facilities. Number two, in Deuteronomy 24 and verse 5, Deuteronomy 24, 5 in the law. Here's the law expressed by God. He says that when a man and a woman get married, the man should not work for a year, he should not be drafted for a year, but he should cheer up his wife for a year. Now that loses an awful lot in the translation. Let me retranslate that. It says when a man and a woman get married, the man should not work for a year, he should not be drafted into the army for a year, but he should physically shack up with his wife forever, for that whole year. For a year. Thank you, brother. Now, that's the man that wants to hide the law in his heart, I'll tell you. Today, I really wanted to speak on moving from grace back into law. I don't want to be into law myself. I don't know about you people. I'll be glad to give up a little pork for that, I'll tell you that. So, we move into law. Now, the interesting thing is that Hefner never thought this up. God did. And he set it down in his law, and he said, this is the way it is. This is the way to have the best sexual relationship, the best marriage. God said that. Some of you are writing down that reference again. It's Deuteronomy 24:5. All kinds of people, where's that? Where did he put that? As you call your parents tonight, let them know that God said it. I didn't. All right? The third reason why I believe that God is for sex is that he had a fellow write a book about it. The book is entitled What You've Always Wanted to Ask About Sex, But Were Afraid to Do So. You might know it as Song of Solomon. In Song of Solomon in the Old Testament, Solomon expresses there his love affair with his wife. And it is unbelievable. Just laying down principles and attitudes toward sex. Talking about foreplay. Playing with each other's body all the way through. It's a beautiful manual for sex. God had that written. A lot of people don't realize that, and they've gone and said this is the picture of Christ and his church. Well, it may be a picture of Christ and his church, but primarily what it's laying down for us is sex is all right. Sex is beautiful. We'll talk more about the Song of Solomon next week. Then other people get upset about Paul. And they think that Paul is down on marriage. Because Paul was more concerned about who you are than he was who you marry. You have to understand who Paul was writing to. Paul was writing to people in Corinth. And the people in Corinth had a very bad problem. Not only were they immature, the believers there were immature, but they had this temple there called the Temple of Aphrodite. And they worshiped there at this temple. There were 1,000 prostitutes that worked there at the temple. I had a chance last summer to be in Corinth. And where the temple was in Acro-Corinth, way high up a mountain. And you couldn't go up, not even a bus or anything. A tour guide would go up. You'd have to rent a car so you could drive up. Some taxis would go up. And you drive up, and then you have to walk halfway up, too. And there, up on top of this great, high, high peak, is the Temple of Aphrodite. They had 1,000 prostitutes there, so that any time you got a religious urge, you went down and worshipped. And this was the culture. And Paul was writing to that kind of culture, that kind of mentality, that kind of frame of reference. That's why he said it's not good for a man to cling to a woman. He's very concerned about that. Actually, he came across much stronger than I've come across as far as the first two lectures in saying, you must be the man of God. If God leads you into that marriage relationship, go into it. But don't do it unless God leads you into it. Because it'll just slow you down. Paul was pretty smart. So you must understand who Paul was writing to the direction he was coming from. The second misconception is that everybody's doing it. Everybody's doing it. This is a goodie. This is one that I bought for quite some time until I started searching medical journals. As I started going through medical journal after medical journal down here at the medical school, I just read and read and read and read, looking for articles that were dealing with sex, and they're easy to find, but articles that are dealing with the philosophy of sex and this whole business of chastity. And it's an interesting thing that has come up. There's one survey going around the country that has been spread throughout a lot of the national magazines, taken at University of Wisconsin. Anybody here from University of Wisconsin? Yes. Mm-hmm. Okay. Well, at the University of Wisconsin, they not only have committed every sin up there, they invent them and then commit them. It's an interesting place. You can major in inventing sin and then committing it, and you get graded only on how you can commit it. So it's an unusual place. It's probably, it's more Berkeley than Berkeley, probably. But anyway, at the University of Wisconsin, they took a survey. And the survey came out something like this. The survey came out with where they were surveying single girls on the campus. 86% of the girls surveyed slept with at least one person. 86% of the girls surveyed slept with at least one person. 72% of the girls surveyed had slept with more than one person. 86% slept with at least one person. 72% had slept with more than one person. Sounds like everybody's doing it to me. And as you think of being in the 28% or the 14%, all of a sudden you feel weird. Well, Dr. Halleck, who is the head of the medical center there, a very well-known psychiatrist, has written up in the American Medical Association Journal about this survey. He says that the survey was taken like this. They went to the campus and found out that there were 24 shrinks or 24 psychiatrists and psychologists throughout the city of Madison, Wisconsin. They pulled the files of these 24 psychiatrists and psychologists, and they surveyed only psychiatric and psychological patients. In other words, these girls that were surveyed were psychiatric or psychological outpatients. Problem cases, seeking counsel from psychologists and psychiatrists. He then went and surveyed non-patients and came up, this was 3 years ago, he came up with the percentage of 22% of the girls surveyed had slept with at least one guy. Now, he makes this big point, and a lot of other doctors have got on the bandwagon with this, and that's this. He says, permissive sexual activity seems to be highly correlated with mental illness or psychological hang-ups. He says, if you don't have a psychological hang-up when you go into the sexual act, you will have one when you come out. And his point is that people who have psychological needs, deep psychological needs, are expecting sex to meet that need. People who need to be needed, people who need to be loved, people who need to have a self-assurance, people who need to have a self-confidence because a guy can conquer a girl and move her to the point where she gives him her body. He is the one who has a deeper need that sex is not going to provide, because sex is not satisfying in itself, especially just the petting round. So his point is well taken, in that people who are having psychological hang-ups are the ones who were making up the percentage. In other words, that's the everybody. I don't know about you, but I don't want to be part of that everybody. And these figures are nothing to walk around and say, aha, only 22% of Americans. No. I'm sure it's more than that now. But the point is that people who are having problems are the people who are running into this as fast as they can. Number three, the third misconception is that it's a physical act only. It's a physical act only. This is a good one. I read one book where it said, it's just like shaking hands. I don't know really much about this fella, but I do know one thing. It's not like shaking hands. I've shaken hands with many people here today, and just not the same sensation by any means. The whole principle of the one flesh principle in the scriptures is talking about not just body to body, but it's talking about the total personality. Basically, because of one thing. You happen to live in that body. You cannot send your body out for the evening. You go with it. Most people do. And so, therefore, if your body happens to be involved in a sexual act, you happen to be there too. You are observing. You are feeling. You are sensing. You are being programmed. You are being psyched. You are there. Therefore, it's not just a sexual, not just a physical act. There's more to it. It's the total psychology of the thing. You're giving of yourself. You're giving something of your personness to this other person. It's an intimacy that you're giving away. The American Medical Association Journal, Dr. Halleck, in another article, said this: sex is intimately related to interpersonal processes. Promiscuity can still produce emotional problems, and its causative influence is, in practical terms, relatively independent of current social definitions of normative behavior. Let me describe that, translate. What he's saying is, people are saying, well, if we get rid of the rules, we'd be all right. If we could lower the standard, we'd be all right. He said, no. You could throw all the rules out, and still you'd have a guilt, because what happens is, in most sexual cases, especially premarital sexual instances and some marital, premarital sex many times is one person exploiting another person, and you feel guilty for it down in here. One time I was talking to a fellow, and he just said, after I got through speaking, I don't feel a bit guilty. And I've slept with four girls last week. Well, he was very bold about the whole thing. The next week, I was talking to his roommate, just happened to be talking to his roommate. I didn't know his roommate before. It was just on a random. As we were talking, he was describing to me a guy that was so eaten up with guilt on the inside that he couldn't move. The most miserable fellow he'd ever met in his life. So I said, well, who are you talking about? He said, my roommate. Well, who's that? And he told me this guy's name. The guy was being eaten up in here, but out here he was saying, oh, no, not me. Dr. Halleck goes on, the experiences associated with being promiscuous are in themselves stressful and are not conducive to the development of those personality traits generally considered to be that of a healthy individual. The fourth misconception is that I have the natural equipment for sex, why not use it? I have the natural equipment for sex, why not use it? This is like saying to a policeman, buddy, what is that on your hip? Well, that's a revolver. Well, why don't you use it more? Well, I only use it when I have to. But hold on, wait a minute. Let me explain to you my philosophy on other things, all right? You see, when you have natural equipment, you ought to just use it because you got it. I mean, you got it, use it. And so this policeman says, man, that is heavy. And so the policeman starts walking into the room and maybe into drugstores and starts shooting. Just shooting, not people, but shooting. You know, he's using his gun. What a stupid thing. This is the type of thing we're talking about, only on a total different level. It's just like in the class where, when I was in the third grade, a very traumatic year in my life, third grade year, there was a fellow by the name of Johnny Johnson there. Johnny Johnson was the teacher's pet and also her son. And back then, we had an outstanding thing going, and I'm sure if any of you were honest enough, you would admit the same thing, although I won't ask for a showing of hands because this does get a little gross. But what we did in the third grade is we had this thing going of who could spit the farthest and who could spit most accurately. We would get around and line up and we'd get ready and get it all ready to go, you know, we'd have a little can out there. Well, Johnny Johnson was just the greatest spitter ever was. Kid was just unusual for his age, no doubt about it. And he would spit sometimes 15, 20 feet. It was just amazing how far this guy could spit, just with a great accuracy. Amazing kid. I never could get it. I'd just get up here and just kind of fall right there. I was never good at it. I don't know why. But anyway, this Johnson kid was in the classroom. After a while, he was getting kind of cocky with this whole thing. You know, here I am, the greatest spitter in the third grade. And in the classroom, he'd start spitting at people, just to be spitting at people. Sometimes he'd use a little piece of paper and he'd just spit. Or he just used whatever else he had in his mouth. So what he did is, one day I was taking a paper up to my teacher, to Mrs. Johnson. I was going around, and you'd always walk a long way away from Johnny because he would let you have it. So I was going around about three rows over, and he'd never spit that far before. And as I was moving up, he spit at me, and he hit me right over here. Hit me on the ear. I never will forget it. It was just, gross, that's all. And so as I was going up, I took the paper I took the paper up and I went to Mrs. Johnson. I was so mad. I said, Mrs. Johnson? And you can imagine what a teacher thought of me when I came up. Mrs. Johnson? And Mrs. Johnson was scared to death. She said, don't you ever talk to me like that. I said, but Mrs. Johnson, and I pointed up here, and she said, what do you have on your ear? Go to the restroom and clean it off. She really got upset with me. So I said, but Mrs., don't you talk back to me. All right, you're staying in the corner the rest of the afternoon. And there I was. All because a guy thought he had the natural equipment and he was using it. Now I realize I've gone to the extreme, but I wanted to illustrate. That's the philosophy. Basically, there are two things wrong with that philosophy. There are two things wrong with that misconception. Number one, there's a lack of responsibility. There's a lack of responsibility. I've got the natural equipment for sex. Why not use it? You must have responsibility in using it. That's why. Secondly, there doesn't seem to be much thought for the other person. I have the natural equipment for sex. Why can't I use it? Okay? The fifth misconception is it helps to see if we're compatible. It helps to see if we're compatible. Now, you'll remember the unusual diagram from yesterday, the day before. And the other day I heard many oohs and ahs as I drew this picture. And you remember that one of these is a guy and one of these is a girl. And we went through all this before. With a body, a soul, and spirit. Now, which of these three areas are they talking about when they say we want to see if we're compatible? Which of these three? You talk to me. The body, thank you. The body. In other words, they're just talking about physical compatibility. Dr. Sanders, who is a psychiatrist writing in Medical Aspects of Human Sexuality. It's a recent periodical only dealing with sex. He says, if they proceed to prove mechanical compatibility, a less than 1% problem, they endanger psychological compatibility, a more than 99% problem, in the process. What he's saying is, if a couple is trying to prove that they're compatible here, it's stupid. Basically, because many psychiatrists are saying there is no such thing as physical incompatibility. They're saying the problem is up here. It's psychological incompatibility, and the physical is only an expression of your psychological relationship with each other. This is so true. And in the counseling situations that I've had over and over and over again with married couples, I'm seeing more and more that what their relationship is like on the spiritual level, what their relationship is like on the soulish level, that will tell an awful lot of what's going on in their sex life. And if there's something wrong with the sex life, don't deal with the sex immediately. Go back up and find out what's wrong up here. That's the compatibility you better be concerned about, because that's the compatibility that's going to make your sex life sexy. Okay? Number 6. I have a desire. Why not satisfy it? This is pretty much the same as 4. It has two basic problems. It lacks a sense of responsibility, and it's not looking out for the other person. I have a desire. Why not satisfy? There's nothing wrong with having a desire. If you have a desire, that's natural. That's normal. If you don't have a desire, you may be wired wrong. But we're not going to talk about that. So we're moving in that way, and there's nothing wrong with having a desire. It's what you do with those desires. It's what you do with those desires. Paul says, take those desires and tell the Lord you have those desires. And says he'll give you the peace that passes all understanding. Philippians 4, 6, and 7. Now let's move into the subject of petting. Petting has often been defined as love by the Braille system. Doesn't always happen on a blind date, but... No. Let me give you a definition for petting. Sexual stimulation that leads directly to loss of control. Sexual stimulation that leads directly to loss of control. Sexual stimulation that leads directly to loss of control. Notice that I did not say sexual satisfaction. Petting is not sexual satisfaction. Petting is sexual stimulation ending in frustration because you haven't gone any further. Sexual stimulation that leads directly to loss of control. There are 3 points I want to give under petting. First of all, describing petting. Petting is an automatic transmission. Petting is an automatic transmission, leading the person toward intercourse. In other words, petting and intercourse are a package deal. You don't have one without the other. Now, I know that's very trite, that's very simple, but I find many, many, many people don't understand that. They just think petting is petting. But petting has a purpose. Petting is moving the person toward intercourse. It's moving the couple toward intercourse. And you don't have petting without intercourse. You should be moving on to go all the way because it's a package deal. Secondly, petting is a habit. There's a computer effect in petting. It's a habit. Once you begin in any form, any level, any degree of petting, you always return to that form or degree and move on further. But at least you return to that same form, that same level, that same degree of petting. How far you've gone dictates how far you'll go next time. The third is there's a law of diminishing returns in petting. And that means that you're going to want to go on further than you did the last time. So petting is an automatic transmission. Petting is a habit. There's a computer effect there. And thirdly, petting has the law of diminishing returns. There's never any satisfaction, total satisfaction. Let's look at these for a moment. Automatic transmission. And the automatic transmission point is this, that once you begin the loss of control through sexual stimulation, once you begin the process, the emotional processes that are taking off in this whole area, once that's on, it's just like you press a button and everything takes over, and all of a sudden you're controlled by your emotions, you're controlled by the whole scene, you're controlled by the whole situation that you find yourself in. At that point, you're moving through, let's say there's a four-gear ratio, and you get to second gear, and you stop. When you stop, you walk away and say, wow, we didn't go all the way. Didn't go too far at all, only went to second gear. That's pretty good. Thank you, Lord. And you walk away. Now, you think you're pretty good for that because you haven't gone too far. And especially the guys, they think, well, I tell you, I got control like you just can't believe. We just went second gear. Now, the girl is sitting over there dying in a pile because the girl is the one who's been programmed in the most sensitive way, in the most distinct way, because that's the way girls are, guys. Girls are more sensitive, and you are programming them psychologically. You are programming them during that time of petting so that she is very, very frustrated. And guys can walk away and say, well, we didn't go too far. But the girl sitting back there going out of her mind, but afraid to say anything to you. And the way she might say something to you is say, well, that's not. And you'll say, okay, we won't. And an hour later, you are, because you persuaded her. And most girls just completely come unglued at this point. And a guy says, I love you, they just completely, right there. Totally wiped out. Melt, right there. Amazing. We'll deal with that in a moment. Anyway, the automatic transmission effect is, and the computer effect with that, the whole point is that you're psychologically programming that girl every time. You're programming that girl. If you would keep stopping at second gear over and over again, I'm convinced if you would get married after, say, you've done this 10 times in a period of 2 weeks or so, let's say you'd get married the next day. I'm convinced when you came to that point, in the marriage bed, nothing's wrong at all. Here you are in marriage. On your first night, I'm convinced you'll stop at second gear. Because there's a computer effect. You've built in, you've programmed a stop in that relationship. And as people who that I've had an opportunity to talk with and counsel with, as I've talked with them, realizing maybe they were unbelievers before they did all this, but what happened is everything they've done, all kinds of things they've done before marriage, when they got into marriage, it's had some kind of effect. And basically, because they didn't know what to do about it, they were hurting and wondered, why do I feel this way about this woman? Why am I not totally satisfied that what she's doing for me? It might be because you've built up habits over here. You've built up this computer effect over here. Very, very unhealthy psychologically. And I wish I could put you up at a book on my bookshelf and let you listen as I counsel different people. As they come in and sit down and just cry and cry and cry and say, I don't know what to do. I feel trapped. Why do girls pet? I'm just going to give you four things I've listed. I'm sure there are many more. And you ought to read especially the chapter on petting in Design for Christian Marriage. Excellent. I think, first of all, sometimes girls pet to be popular. But if a girl pets to be popular, she's probably popular only because she pets, not because of who she is. Secondly, it seems like it's an obligation. It's a price that you must pay for the night's entertainment. Thirdly, there may be a desire there that you just need to be loved. You need to be, you want to be needed. Number four, fun. Why do guys pet? Just to keep it even, we'll go four. Number one, it's fun. Somebody said number two, three, and four, it's fun. Number two, it gives a guy a self-assurance. Number three, also a desire to be needed. Number four, there's a sense of success. There's a sense of a mastery over someone else if a guy can bring a girl to that point of no control. Now, there are many, many other things, and you can list them probably much better than I. But we could list and list and list and realize some motives that are wrong motives for petting. Now, as we look back at this whole scene, there are three kinds of love, as you've heard many times, I'm sure. The first is Eros. And we must hurry. Eros. Eros is the kind of love that says, I love you because. That's E-R-O-S, that little squiggly thing at the end of that. Eros says, I love you because you do this for me. I love you if you do this for me. As long as you keep putting out, as long as you keep acting this way, I love you. I love you to the end, if. Okay? I like your body. Let's go out tonight. Basically, it's saying, I love you because I love me. It's an ego-centered kind of love. The second kind of love is philia. Philia says, I like you. I like you. It goes along with the soul, the personality. I like you. I like what you do. I like what you say. I like how you act. I like you. It's a mutual admiration. Now, a guy could say, I love you and mean Eros. And still it comes across, L-O-V-E, I love you. And you hear him say, I love you. You need to check out what he's saying, girl. When he says, I love you, and you completely start to catch yourself falling apart, completely coming unglued, melting right there in the front seat, there you are, completely falling out of your wits. What you need to say is, what's he mean by that? Now, if I were going to propose to you, and I would come and I'd say, I like your body. Let's get married. You don't marry somebody because they like your body. In other words, this is not a good basis for marriage. Or if I come and I say, you know, I really like you. I mean, you know, I don't want to go too far this whole thing, but I like you. Why don't we get married? You don't marry somebody because they like you. I used to have a dog named Spot. I liked him. It's just no basis for marriage. The third kind of love, of course, is agape, and this is all, this agape has its source only in a believer. Only in a believer. Only believers can love agape style. I used to say that probably only believers love agape style. Now I say only believers love agape style. Sila. That's it right there. They do. Only believers. John 15 talks about the world and says the world would love you if you would be like they are. You know what word he uses? Philia. Not agape. They would love you if they would be like, they could only like you. But agape is the kind of love that I love you no matter what. I love you no matter what you do, no matter what you say, no matter how you look. I love you. I love you, period.
I love you.
It's an even though kind of love. I love you. Even though you did that, I love you. It's an awful kind of love in some respects, because you can't ask the question, why do you love me? Because the person can't list a bunch of stuff all along, unless they're talking down here about philia. But when they're talking about agape, they say, I just love you. I just take it at that. I love you. That's agape. And that's the kind of glue that really pulls a relationship together and holds it there. Now, the problem is that we have a lot of people starting down here in the body-to-body relationship. They see a girl going down the street and they go, whoosh, that's physical, see? They did not say, wow, what a soul that kid's got. That's not what they're saying. What they're saying is that the soul has an unusual frame around it, what they're saying, right? And they're saying, wow, just like Adam said when Eve was hand-picked. Now, this messes up all kinds of relationships. We need to start up here with spiritual relationships with all kinds of people, girls and guys, spiritual relationships. Moving on into the soulish relationship where I like you. Now, I have a lot of spiritual relationships with a lot of people, and I have girls and guys, and I have soulish relationships with a lot of people. But I have a physical relationship with my wife, you see? The problem is we bring in this physical relationship before marriage. And when that comes in the premarital sense, it breaks the principle of life, because God says, look, that's not the place to have it. The best way to do it is to keep it for marriage. And when we bring it in before that, basically four things take place, or four reasons why you should not bring in the physical before marriage, aside from that it's breaking the principle of life. Okay? Number one, it's the wrong motive. There's a wrong motive here. It's an ego type thing. Initially, it may not be the wrong motive. There may be a couple coming together, they're just loving each other, everything's wonderful spiritually, and then soulishly, and all of a sudden the guy realizes, wow, I love her. Like one guy walked into my apartment one time, he just burst in the room. He said, I just met her. I said, you did what? He said, I met her. You met who? I met her. That's great. Why don't you sit down over here, and let's talk this thing through just a little further. Who did you meet? He said, I met my wife. You met your who? I met my wife. Well, the guy was glassy-eyed. He didn't know where he was. I'm sure he didn't know whose apartment he was in. He just came in to express, I met her, you know. Weird guy. Anyway, as he came to the whole thing, he came to his soulish point and said, man, I'm in love with this girl. Well, if the physical would enter in at this point, it may initially be, well, this is just an expression of love. But don't allow it to enter in, because it brings about a wrong motive. Secondly, it fogs the love question. You cannot ask yourself, am I in love, and find out the right answer when you've got a sexual relationship going. You cannot answer that question objectively. It's impossible. I'm becoming more dogmatic in my old age. It's impossible. It fogs the love question. You cannot answer the question objectively, am I in love? It's impossible. Because what you're doing is you're messing around with Eros, and you're saying, now do I love him because of the physical or do I not? Oh, Lord, give me the answer. Well, the Lord has an answer. Quit messing around physically, and I'll give you the answer. If you're messing around physically and trying to say, now, is this really why I'm drawn to him? You'll never know until you quit. So it fogs the love question. Number three, it takes control. Therefore, it de-emphasizes the spiritual and the soulish relationship. When the physical enters in before it should, it takes control. It takes over. It's just like a small pet that you have, a small snake, and the snake grows up and then strangles you to death. That's the way it is. The physical takes over. It becomes the preeminent one in your whole relationship. It's becoming the one, the control factor that takes over, and that's the reason why you get together now. No longer are you having wonderful spiritual communication. No longer is the soulish the greatest, the reason why you get together. But you're getting together because there's a physical relationship. Number four. Every time the physical enters in, it draws a line through your relationship, and you start to break up. You know that one out of three engaged couples break up? You know the reason why most of them break up? Sex. It becomes such a frustration, and all of a sudden the girl feels like, is that why you're coming after me now? Is that why we get together? Or are we getting together to communicate? All that's coming across to her is, I'm after your body, and I'm loving every minute of it. God's very concerned that you're sexy and free and you like it. Rollo May, a great psychologist of our time, says that we have more sex today than we've ever had before, but we sure don't like it. God has a plan where you can like it. He says, I want you to be sexy. I want you to be free. I want you to like it. But you can only do that by following the principle of life that God's laid down. 1 + 1 = 1. That's it. That's all. Now, there's one gnawing question in some of your minds. And that is, what if you've blown it? I've already messed around. Well, congratulations. God's forgiveness is much greater than anything you can ever pull off, anything you could ever do. And God wants you to start on the principle of life. Whenever you realize the principle of life, any principle of life, you start from there. Start from scratch, right there. If you're right now, if you're in an ungodly relationship, you need to cut it off. Paul says, flee from that kind of relationship because you're living in sin and trying to find out God's will at the same time. Living in sin and saying, oh, Lord, lead me on staff. While you're living in sin. No wonder you're having problems with answered prayer. No wonder you're having problems finding out what God's will is. You're living in sin. The way to get out of it is to flee. Don't leave town unless you have to, but flee. Confess it, say, God, that's wrong. That's not right. This is not a godly relationship. And some girls say, well, if I go and tell my guy that, then he'll say, well, just, if I say no more sex, he'll say, forget it. Well, what's he just said? He just said, I love you because you give me sex. You've just found out your answer. Girls, when a guy comes along and gives you those three magic words, I love you, you turn these other three magic words right back to him and say, go hang yourself if you think it's eros. Because you don't want that kind of thing. Don't settle for anything else except that agape relationship. You can be sexy and free and really like it if you follow the principle of life God's laid down in his book. Monday we'll be going into how to choose the mate. How to find that one that God handpicked and put a sign on her and said, she's mine. Okay? Let's pray. Father, thank you for this time. Pray that whatever's been said might be balanced out according to your word by your Holy Spirit. I pray that as we leave, we might not misunderstand things, but we might not, and not, might not be under the pile of guilt or anything. We might deal with that right now. So that you're the preeminent one. So that we're becoming like you. We thank you now in Jesus' name and for his glory. Amen.